Coming up today, the biggest ever search for aliens is launched in London, how genetic data could turn the web into a racist walled garden, and why cheaters around the world are scared for their reputations and their marriages. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from alien attraction to insecure infidelities. I'm your host, Michael Rundle, and I'm editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Leah Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon, Michael.
I'm terrified by the news just announced before we started recording this that former deputy editor of Wired.co.uk, Olivia Salon, is coming in with her mysterious French beagle, is that right?
Bulldog.
And I find this extremely threatening as the current editor, and I'm thinking of putting an embargo. But by judging by how excited you are to see this bulldog, this is the most excited I've ever seen you.
Well, I'm very excited to see Liv, but I knew that this would make Katie's day, that there would also be a beazle coming. If you're going to be threatened by anyone, it should be beazle.
Beazle's actually attended several Wired.co.uk podcast recordings before. When he was a puppy, he sometimes used to fall asleep in Liv's arms while we were recording.
Oh, okay, my God.
Not entirely true. When he was a puppy, he would come in here and attack all of Jeremy, our gear editor's very expensive equipment.
I really feel like someone should have mentioned this to me when I started on the podcast. I've really got to raise my game. I haven't got any cute animals at all.
Well, if you just breathe really heavily,
yeah, you'll basically do an
slobber,
impression.
And we'll just,
next week I'm bringing in a baby grizzly bear. How cute would that be? Okay. Possibly violent, but very cute. Okay, well, that's good to know. I've got to raise my game. Anyway, it's news time. So first up this week, we saw the most expensive and biggest ever attempt to contact or listen to alien civilizations elsewhere in the galaxy ever launched. The Breakthrough Listen project has been given a $100 million investment by the Russian tech investor Yuri Milner. And the launch was held this week at the Royal Society in London with Professor Stephen Hawking, Astronomer Royal Lord Martin Rees, and a bunch of other luminaries. And it sounds extremely exciting.
You couldn't really ask for better people behind it.
No, and I mean, I personally have a huge admiration for Martin Rees. And every time I hear him speak, I just get completely fascinated. But what's interesting about this is there's a second component called Breakthrough Message, which is looking at the ethics of attempting to send our own messages out into space. So to take a step back, we've been looking for signals and signs of other civilizations elsewhere in the galaxy for more than 50 years. This was pioneered by the SETI project and has been continuing for decades. And basically the aim is to find a signal which could only be artificial. And that's a complex and difficult thing because the amount of possible signals there could be and the range of light waves or radio waves in which they could be arriving is enormous. And it's also led to a bunch of amazing incidents in the past decades where people thought they found messages from outer space and it turned out to be quasars or, in one case, I think, a microwave next to one of the listening devices.
Amazing.
But it's been continuing for a long time. And obviously, SETI has been more recently using volunteers' computer power. 9 million people around the globe dedicate their computer power when they're not using it to try and looking through this data that we collect from huge radio telescopes and try and find signs of other civilizations.
And still nothing.
Well, the problem is there's some fundamental issues. SETI has never been very well funded. And so being able to plan ahead has been very difficult for the project. And getting time, significant time, on some of the world's biggest telescopes has also been very difficult because obviously, theoretically, one of these messages could be passing us by at any one moment. And if we were not looking in the right place at the right time, we could miss it. So it's been a very spotty project. The amount of data that's come in has been a bit haphazard. And it hasn't been a very straightforwardly easy project to go through. So Breakthrough Listen is an attempt to basically put all of that right. So it's going to be a 10-year project working with teams at the Robert C. Byrd Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia and the Parkes Telescope in Australia. They're going to be looking at a vastly bigger amount of information coming from space, many more different wavelengths of possible radio signals and light signals. And it's going to be done in a much more rigorous and thought-through way. And potentially, it could be our best chance yet of seeing if there is a signal from another civilization or intelligence outside our solar system.
Is that the first time then that they've been able to you know, attain access to these telescope for such a long period of time, rather than, like you say, kind of begging and borrowing. And
it's about consistency. So yeah, the SETI project has had access to other telescopes and I think some, both those specific telescopes, in short bursts. But obviously these are hugely expensive instruments, and being able to get time on them is really a matter of money. So you have every institution in the world who is competing for time on these telescopes.
Not much money in hunting aliens.
And there's not much money in hunting aliens. And unless you have someone like Yuri Milner who comes along and really puts a lot of focus and dedication to it.
And Hawking really spoke out about it, didn't he, on Monday? He was very excited.
They're both very excited. I mean, they both have different viewpoints on what this kind of intelligence or civilization could be as well, and what the implications would be for humanity. So just to quickly cover a few more details, the project, as announced, believe they'll be able to find anything with the power of a common aircraft radar being broadcast by anywhere between the closest 1,000 stars to Earth, which is a huge amount. But the question is what that civilization might look like. Mm. And Martin Rees made, I think, quite a big but interesting leap, putting out the proposal, really, that this is unlikely to be coming from a planet. It's unlikely to be organic life because of the evolution of organic beings to artificial intelligence. It's much more likely, statistically, that this is going to be an artificial intelligence, or that the signals might be being broadcast inadvertently rather than purposefully, which is fascinating, really. But this all comes down to the question of, do we want to contact aliens or not? But the ethics of that are serious. So Stephen Hawking has spoken out in the past about the dangers of making contact with aliens, that this would be equivalent to humans making contact with an ant. You know, the technological difference would be so vast that it could put us at serious danger. Whereas Martin Rees is more of the opinion that it's, if they are making contact, they're already so advanced they can probably
they're looking for someone.
He actually said they probably know we're here already and have been watching us for a while, not in a kind of really spooky creepy flying saucers way, but in a kind of distant observational way.
Well, why, if they've got the technology to hear us, wouldn't they want to be communicating with us, Michael, unless they were trying to get all the information they could before they wipe us out of the universe?
Well, that's true. I mean, but this all comes down to the Drake equation, which is the equation of the likelihood of finding life elsewhere in the galaxy, named after the man who started SETI and was at the launch this week at the Royal Society. The Drake equation is a bit of a misnomer because all of the factors, all of the different amounts, so, you know, that's the number of planets, the number of galaxies, the chance of life, all those things are all unknown. But it comes down to the idea of how likely is it that another civilization is out there broadcasting material at the right time so that we can find it at the right moment for, you know...
Really unlikely.
All of those things are really unlikely. But if it's possible, if it happened, it would be the most fundamental discovery, perhaps, in science for hundreds of years, if not ever. Which I think is why Yuri Milner, who is obviously a very wealthy man, is putting $100 million behind it. It's not a huge amount of money for him, probably, but it's a huge amount for the SETI project, which has never had that kind of funding before.
Oh, wow. So basically, if we don't find life in the next 10 years, Milner's going to be a bit peeved.
I think so. But I mean,
so are the rest of us, frankly.
I think he believes that ultimately we will find it if there is a signal out there. And that we'll learn more about how to look for those signals and the types of things we're looking for, in the same way as the search for exoplanets. NASA this week, we're hoping, at time of recording, we haven't actually heard yet, is going to be preparing to announce the discovery of the most Earth-like planet around a distant star ever.
But that's one of those things where we keep getting lots of fruits for our labour. You know, the Kepler project has been really successful in identifying exoplanets and Earth-like planets to a certain degree. But, I mean, for SETI, this is hardcore people that are dedicated to something that they are well aware they probably won't see in their lifetime, or they'd be ridiculously lucky to.
I suppose that's why it's hard for them to get funding for it, because there aren't necessarily going to be the results that they want.
There's also no end in sight, because there's never going to come a day where humans are going to say, yeah, let's stop looking, it's definitely not out there. So this could go on forever.
Well, this also plays into another factor that was discussed at the meeting, which is what it's like for scientists working on these projects. So obviously this is a lot of money. It's going to be able to pay for a lot of scientists to work on this for a long time. But Drake was pointing out that the excitement for this kind of thing dims very quickly. Mm. If you're a scientist, essentially you're searching through a haystack, finding nothing. Yeah. And it drives people mad, or, you know, can affect their careers, because obviously there's going to be no publishable papers that can come out of this for a scientist who's, or a research assistant who's working on this kind of project.
That's a story. How many lives has this ruined?
Well, I think what ultimately happens is that people dedicate time around other projects that they're doing, or they dedicate half a day a week, or
So there's never the focus that we need.
Right, but that's also difficult because how people then structure their careers around that, or how you manage to pay consistently over a long period of time, or how you have people who are trained and experienced doing it, is hugely complicated. And I think that's what this money is partly going to go towards, is establishing a structure for the project that means this work can be consistently carried out.
Yeah, people can survive.
I think I'm right in thinking that there's also going to be a reward in place as well, which should potentially encourage people to kind of commit time to this. Because, you know, if there has to be some kind of incentive at the end of this other than just sort of finding life out there, I suppose.
That's true. So this is a slightly separate thing to the full-scale $100 million project. Mm. Yeah, there'll be $1 million prize for an external team who can look through this data and find a signal which signifies the potential of an intelligence somewhere in the galaxy. And that's also related to Yuri Milner, obviously, has founded the Breakthrough Prize, a very glitzy Oscar-style science prize that takes place in California with lots of celebrities and all kinds of exciting people attending. So that builds into that as well. I think Yuri Milner is obviously trying to give a higher profile to lots of interesting science. We'll just have to wait and see what happens with this over the next 10 years. So, Leah, this week we saw another interesting science project being co-opted for rather unfortunate reasons.
Yeah, it's not quite such an uplifting story as Michael's. I'd like to first start by asking you both, why would you choose to pay £125 to 23andMe to find out your ancestral history?
Well, I suppose, you know, if you're the kind of person that is naturally interested in ancestry anyway, and, you know, you're the kind of person that wants to put together your family tree and understand who you are and where you're from, £125 doesn't seem like a huge amount in order to be able to do that. Mm. You know, people pay subscriptions already to kind of family tree websites and that kind of thing.
Yes.
And
that's a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And
I think it's just sort of an interesting curiosity, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is, Michael.
And there's also the kind of the medical side of it as well, which 23andMe offers as part of their service. I think two different strands. There's the ancestry side and then the kind of medical side, which looks for potential problems that might lie ahead from you you according
prepare
to your
future.
Genetics. And you know, to kind of sort of tackle those problems in advance before they arise, and to be aware that you might be at risk of something.
Preempt it. Yeah. Look after yourself. So probably not because you want to wall yourself off from humanity by proving that you're at least 80% European.
No.
It wasn't on my list.
That wasn't on your list. I don't think it's on most people's lists. I don't think it's on anyone's list, really. But the weird thing this week was someone who was calling themselves Offensive Computing joined GitHub, having created a piece of code that could be used to access 23andMe's API and block people from apps and websites based on their DNA.
So this is a kind of a theoretical or a proof of concept implementation of quite a disturbing idea, which would be blocking off chunks of the internet to people of different ethnicities or genetic backgrounds.
Yeah, and of course it is, well, to an extent a proof of concept, because there's only, I think, 1 million people that have used 23andMe's tests to have their DNA sequenced. So that's just a drop in the ocean. There's no way it would work. You can't wall off the internet using this piece of code yet, because not enough people have their genetic data, but one day they will. And this person seems to be looking forward to that future. It basically works like any other kind of authentication tool, you know, that Facebook might use. It's called OAuth2 to request permissions from 23andMe about your genetic makeup. So you're having to pass on this quite private data to these websites that have decided you're only allowed to access them if you're a woman, or if you're European, or if you're a particular ethnic group. So
now the creator did offer some justifications.
He did.
As much as they were.
Good justifications or just justifications?
Well, whoever did this, they tried to paint it as a tool for creating safe spaces for marginalised groups to escape trolls on the internet. So this tool that a tiny proportion of the entire world could potentially use, this person is saying it's to protect people, which is, of course, rubbish, because you would never escape the trolls using this. There's just not enough people using it if they chose to. And the user, I keep saying he, but it could be a she, obviously. It could be an it, could be an AI. Who knows? pointed out as an example of a marginalized victim group, half the world's population, women, saying they could use it to have women's only sites. Also suggested Hasidic Jews might like to bar Ashkenazi or Sephardic Jews. NAACP in the US might want to filter its members and make sure that they are indeed of African descent. I don't know. Maybe that's the tool that people need.
I think the reality is that those justifications weren't quite believable.
No, I don't think so. So they're not believable in the slightest.
So you got in touch with 23andMe. What did they say in response?
Yeah, they were right on it. They've barred it. They basically have quite a strict review process for anyone using their API. Only 20 people can have access to any code using the API before 23andMe's review process will kind of kick in, and they can grant or deny full access to the API. And a spokesperson said this app clearly violates our API policy. We've shut down the application, and this developer no longer has access to our API. Using our API to develop applications that contain, display, or promote hate is prohibited by our API terms of service. So, yeah, there was no question in their mind that this is, you know, a product of some kind of racism or sexism or all of the above, more likely.
But this is obviously a limited case, but the potential, or the fact that this kind of demonstrates one theoretical use of genetic data, if it were gathered on a wider scale, is relatively disturbing. There's a bit of a Gattaca dystopia element to this.
Yeah, it's super disturbing because, I mean, some of the things that the user did suggest as uses, you could almost see people thinking, yeah, this is a good idea, because there were really practical reasons. Things like ensuring pharmacies don't dispense drugs that someone might have a bad reaction to based on their genetic code, interacting with multiple different types of drugs they're using. Or there was a really even more bizarrely specific one about safer online dating, where they'll prevent people from pairing up with someone that they might one day go on to have children, and the children would then, you know, have passed on some genetic disease because these two pairings have come together. So those are really kind of practical things that you might feasibly want to use this for, and it's definitely the future will definitely be one whereby we're all having our genetic code sequenced for peanuts, and we're living our lives according to that information. We're probably each changing our diets, and we're changing our exercise routines according to what that data says about us. But it could seep into so many different areas of your life, and it could sound reasonable at the beginning. Like, yeah, I don't want to end up marrying someone who I'm going to not be able to have children with biologically. Maybe that'll be a concern in the future when your genetic code is, you know, so visible. And so it just becomes just like anything else in your life that you think about every day.
I think this raises a whole bigger question, though, about data, and in particular health data, and how it's policed and how it's used. And obviously there are these really practical applications that, you know, we would be foolish not to look into, because, you know, preventative healthcare, all sorts of things can kind of come out of this data that can benefit us all enormously, and, you know, can potentially transform healthcare systems and, you know, economies and that kind of thing.
But it could be used for great evil.
It could be. It could be. And increasingly, I know there are a lot of people out there that aren't so concerned about data and who has access to it. And I think there's an ongoing debate about that. But when it comes to health data particularly, and looking at how it can be used to discriminate against people, and you know, sort of affect insurance and all that kind of thing as well, you know,
for applying for a job even.
Exactly. And, you know, as more of this health data becomes available to us, you know, and it's in our hands, we have to make sure that we are so in control of who has access to it and where it goes and what's done with it. And I mean, that's an enormous problem that should be being tackled, I think, by all of the people that are contributing to building these services.
Yeah, because we live in a world today where we're very happy to give away our data for free services, and we're being encouraged more and more to use health trackers, fitness trackers for our own benefit, but we're also sharing that information, that a limited amount of that information with companies. And like you say, to what extent, we're so used to not having control of our data like that. I mean, some people do and some people prioritize it and protect it, but the majority of people, I think, don't. They're happy to use free services. So one day when, you know, we have this vast amount of data, I mean, even when 23andMe gives you the health data, I think, you know, it's stuff that you can't interpret yourself all the time, and you can have a lot of misunderstandings from it. So there will be a whole industry built up around interpreting that for you and making recommendations instantly and updating you on your phone or your smartwatch about those recommendations. And what are we just going to trust people because we think it's good for us?
There was another big data and security story this week.
There was.
Which affected 37 million people and could affect a similar amount of marriages, Katie.
That's right. So this was one of the big news stories of this week. Ashley Madison, if you haven't heard of it, is a website that encourages married people to sign up in order to find others like them who would like to have an extramarital affair.
And there's 37 million of them out there.
Well, there's 37 million registered users.
And what we have to remember is that not all of those people might actually be married and searching. They might be people who are, happy to have an illicit affair with somebody who's married but aren't perhaps married themselves. So
there may also be people who signed up, didn't use it, but weren't able to delete their account, which also builds into why this devastating hack happened this week.
That's right. So the people that were responsible for this, a group called the Impact Team, they kind of claim responsibility for the hack, and they threatened to publish people's secret sexual fantasies and the account details of millions of users unless the site was permanently closed. Now, part of the reason that they did this, as Michael just mentioned, was that an element of Ashley Madison is that if you do want to delete your account, you are forced to pay a fee. I think it's about £15 in the UK.
And that's to kind of fully wipe everything. So all those like S&M photos, you know, your preferences, your address.
Well, I think it also, unusually for a social network, would remove messages from other people's accounts to whom you had sent messages.
Like you never existed.
Yeah, it's a full wipe. Yeah. But essentially for anyone who's feeling any remorse or recrimination, they can take themselves back off.
Well, they're just worried about being found out.
Well, yeah, sure.
Well, I mean, this is in theory, but what the hackers say is that users' purchase details are not removed as promised and include real name and address, which are of course some of the most important information that the users will want removed. You know, the things that really identify them specifically, and you know, you couldn't. If the messages were still there, for example, but they couldn't be traced back to you, and your real name and your address, then you know there might be something that could help you get out of.
Isn't there a point largely that although you're paying to have your account deleted, they're not also deleting the record of you asking to have your account deleted? So you're still on there as having requested your account be deleted, which would heavily implicate you.
Oh, is that the main thing they're keeping?
I believe so.
I thought they were keeping kind of card details.
Yeah, because of the payment you have to make
to remove it. Oh, the final one.
But I mean, you know,
well, I like that's their excuse anyway. I mean, they're like, we, you know, are worried that you're not protecting their privacy, so we're going to publish all their names.
Yeah. and also, I mean, not that I necessarily feel like I should excuse Ashley Madison, but it's not just the site that's going to have a record of that. It's your bank statement as well. It's not like, you know, there has to be with those financial transactions, it's very difficult to completely obscure them. So it's not as though it's just the company that's going to have a record of that.
I must say, it's not a hack that upset me much. I mean, I want people's privacy protected. Shouldn't have people's names and addresses and bank account details, obviously very terrible. But of all the sites that could be hacked,
I suppose that it really depends on, you know, whether you kind of find the idea of infidelity in a marriage kind of really abhorrent, which a lot of people do. But at the same time, you know, if you really value privacy and also the fact that you know there are a lot of these kind of sites and services online that are, you know, perhaps encouraging interesting sexual behaviours, and, you know, there are catering for all tastes and all habits.
This is catering to cowards that want to hide their infidelity securely.
But
this isn't for people that need to explore their sexual appetites behind closed doors.
Well, I mean,
adult relationships are complicated things. No, but you know, there's a large proportion of people who at some point will have an affair. I mean, that is a reality of marriage. No, I mean, it's a consistently large number of people. No, but you know, I think what Ashley Madison would say, and I don't want to speak on their behalf, and I'm not necessarily saying I agree with them, but they would say that their site would enable someone to do something they're going to do anyway, but cause less harm because they're not having an affair with someone they know well or that can easily be revealed. And so
no, people are still stupid. They'll still have messages on their phones. Well,
I think it's a little bit harsh to point at a piece of the internet you find morally distasteful and then say you're glad to have their accounts revealed in public.
I didn't say glad. I'm saying it's not the worst one. If any website was going to have this done to it, to prove a point.
Actually, my first reaction was not to cast any kind of moral judgment on the people that are using those sites, because I'm not in their position. I'm not married. I don't know what it's like to be married for 20 years, and I'm not going to project that onto anyone. The one thing that did kind of disturb me was when I went onto the kind of press section of the site and was looking at some of the images that were there, and I saw the CEO of Ashley Madison posing provocatively with all these women, and it was just distasteful to me, but it was just a bit kind of creepy, and that was the only thing that made me go,
"Ooh, selling the dream."
Noel Biderman, who is the CEO of Ashley Madison, is an interesting fellow. If you ever read an interview with him, he's quite vociferous about the moral reaction that some people have to his service, but he also said this week that he believes he knows who did it.
Yeah, that's right. He said in a statement to the tech blog Krebs on Security, which was the site that originally reported this hack, I've got their profile right in front of me, all their work credentials. Cool. It was definitely a person here that was not an employee, but certainly had touched our technical services. So that person probably, if Noel is indeed telling the truth about that, is probably on their way to
jail.
Trouble right now, because Ashley Madison is working with law enforcement to pursue the perpetrator, and actually called the attack cyber terrorism.
Although we don't actually know that they have all the details. There's no proof that this...
Well, we do know Ashley Madison has confirmed the attack, and some of the details have been published, so not actually user details, I don't think. As far as it's kind of more company details.
So it could be a bluff.
I think given Ashley Madison's reaction and, you know, not denying that the hack has happened and that the hackers, the only thing that they've countered that the hackers have said is this argument that they don't delete everything. They're saying that's not true. But they haven't said that the hackers haven't actually accessed all this information. So in theory, I mean, the last update we had from Ashley Madison was a statement saying that they were pursuing the perpetrator.
And so they've waived that fee now, so you can wipe your details for free.
They've waived the fee.
But which may be a bit late.
It may be a bit late. But we still... As far as we know, the hacker is still out there with all that information. So things seem to be hanging in the balance somewhat for those Ashley Madison members who perhaps have used the service in the past and don't know quite what's going on right now, whether their affairs will be revealed or whether they won't.
This is clearly one of those stories that could change at any point. Probably by the time this podcast goes out, everything will be completely different. But yeah, definitely one to watch. Well, that's all the news this week. Still to come, drone owners who don't want to get arrested, listen up. We're going to take you through the newly codified drone code and what it means for amateur robot flight directors in the UK.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
So we hear more and more about drones these days, both in theatres of war and conflict and above our skies, above our aeroplanes, and in our gardens with our kids. But they are more serious toys and devices than sometimes we like to accept. And there are a huge amount of regulations and laws that govern their use. Unfortunately, it's not always been easy to actually understand what they mean or get them all in a single place. And that's something the Civil Aviation Authority wanted to tackle this week, Katie.
That's right. So until a few years ago, actually, drones were mainly associated with the military. And, you know, that was the kind of image of drones, and a lot of sort of professional amateur drone users in the UK and abroad were trying to actually get them to be called quadcopters or something else, to change this name, because they didn't want what they do with their drones to be associated with the military drones. But since then, there's just been this incredibly quick proliferation in the number of drones that are available, and toys, and actually drones are very much known by that name now. I think the people that are arguing that they should be called quadcopters and that kind of thing have kind of lost that battle, really, because the idea of drones in our minds is not now just the military style.
I think this is the key point with drones, right, in that essentially these are remote control helicopters or planes, and those are things which have existed for a very, very long time, and that people have been using and that regulations have been governing for an equally long period of time. I mean, it's never been legal, I think, you know, in decades, to fly a remote controlled aeroplane next to a passenger jet. The difference with drones, so-called, or quadcopters, really, is that they're easy to use. And that's why they're so fun, is you can just get one and turn it on and it hovers in place. And that was never possible with a remote control helicopter. I can't tell you the amount of hours I spent as a kid trying to get one of those things to work, and it never worked. It just got blown away in the wind or whatever. And drones are easy to use. And what that means is that it opens up many more possibilities for abuse, because with no training, you can set one of these things up and fly to the top of the Shard and record footage from 300 meters above London, and then your battery runs out and then your drone falls on somebody.
Or as in the US, when a college student decides to strap guns to one.
Well, we'll get to that. First, why don't you tell us about what the Drone Code actually covers and sort of what its intent is.
Okay, well, so you were right, Michael, when you basically said that all of this legislation that governing drones have been in place for decades. So the same rules that have covered model aircraft in the past apply in exactly the same way they did to those that they did to drones. But the reason that they've decided to create this drone code is that people aren't necessarily aware of all of the rules, and
no one reads them.
You know, and also, like, you know, like I said, you can buy a drone that fits in your hand if you're a kid for £10 from a toy shop now. So the idea is that they really need to spread awareness of what the rules are. So they've kind of codified these this week and created a special drone code in order to explain to everybody who might use a drone what they can and cannot do. So first up, drones are going to have to be kept within the pilot's line of sight and must not be flown above a maximum height of 400 feet. Drones must be kept away from aircraft, helicopters, airports and airfields. Moreover, drones fitted with cameras must not be flown within 50 metres of people, vehicles, buildings or structures, over congested areas or large gatherings such as concerts and sporting events.
You feel like with that one they're just going to get better cameras with better zoom.
Well, but also I think that strays into an area where the drone code and the CAA really stretch the extent to which people are realistically going to follow this. I mean, many drones come with cameras. Parrots, you know, drones are fantastic. They have, I think, 1080p cameras on them now. There's no way that people are not going to fly these within 50 meters of people. It's just not realistic.
Yeah,
or buildings. And also, that's the fun.
Well, but I mean, does that cover flying it in your garden at home? Which most people, I think, would be a reasonable use, although obviously clearly not according to the law.
No, because you'll be filming your neighbours.
And also, if you do have one of these really tiny drones, then, you know, you probably can fly it safely. You can probably fly it safely inside if you know what you're doing and if it's just a tiny little toy.
Well, the parrot drones are sold specifically so you can fly them inside because they have a bouncy protective cover.
But they've sucked the fun out. This just sounds like you have to stand in a field by yourself with your camera-equipped drone.
I think their point is that is really the only way to use them and be sure that they're not going to hurt anyone.
And, you know, I think you're right in that people are definitely not going to abide by these. They don't now and they aren't going to in the future. But I think what the CAA wants to remind people is that, you know, if you do this and are caught and cause damage to somebody or someone complains about it, or you can actually be prosecuted.
So you can be, this is in law.
Yes, and it always has been.
Recommendations, you will be taken, you know, you could potentially be taken to court.
Some extent, I think we in the media take some of the blame for some of the misuse of drones, partly because those drones, at least those that are equipped with cameras, generate amazing footage.
Yeah.
All of which, if it's sufficiently high quality, gets used on tech blogs and newspapers all over the country almost immediately. I remember one specific example of, I mentioned a similar thing earlier, but someone who used a commercially available drone to fly to the top of the Shard at sunset and film around the Shard and around London as the sun was going down and then very slowly came down across the building. And it's an incredible piece of footage, completely illegal.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was used by all publications in London, obviously, and around the world. It was an amazing piece of footage. But the person uploaded it under their real name, had no conception. They were very young, had no conception really of the legal boundaries. There was no drone code or, you know, piece of information included with their product that they bought that would explain those regulations, and found themselves in a lot of trouble. I'm not exactly sure what happened to that person. They definitely pulled the video and faced a lot of criticism immediately from the quadcopter and RC aircraft community, and I think learned their lesson. But the point stands that our appetite for that footage is part of the reason that people misuse drones in this way.
For journalists as well, that will be, I mean, to think you're not allowed to use it around people, around crowds.
Well, you can get separate authorization as a journalist or as any kind of media producer to professionally use it.
The majority of people that do use it for professional purposes like that, like journalists, I wrote a piece last year on the way that the BBC were using drones, and I went in and saw their drone unit, which at the time was just two guys in a basement who like built these drones up themselves and had like bought in gimbals and, you know, made their own kind of camera equipment to be attached to it. I'm sure it's actually transformed now already. But they will be, they're part of these larger communities of people who do take it very seriously and who will get licenses. So there are licenses available for people who want to fly them professionally, and you know, you go and you take a test, and it changes things a little bit.
I think you're also required to have certain kinds of insurance, obviously is a big issue if, you know, these things can go wrong, and that is part of the problem. And again, we've seen numerous examples on the internet of people being injured by drones or drones going out of control, and, you know, that kind of thing does happen. So I think the drone code definitely has, I think it's a good initiative. I think maybe a copy of it should be included in the box with every drone. Mm. But I do think that there is an extent to which it doesn't recognise how people are realistically going to use these things in their private lives, or, you know, to film interesting footage around their home, or, you know, it's complicated and more complicated maybe than the regulations cover.
I think the thing that they are most concerned about is the fact that there have been several incidents where drones have been flown very close to aircraft, obviously causing massive amounts of danger to many, many people. And I think, you know, in order to, I'd very much doubt that people will be prosecuted for kind of minor infringements. But it's these major things that they're particularly trying to make people aware of, which seems very sensible to me. And actually, you know, there is this massive community out there of kind of professional people who work in, who've worked in aviation for years, who love using drones. And the Civil Aviation Authority has consulted with a lot of them, and you know, with the Pilots Association and the Pilots Union, in order to kind of put these guidelines together. And what they want to do is they don't want to stop people from using them and buying them. They want to encourage people to be creative, and they think it's a great thing. But, you know, there are real safety concerns and things. There have been incidents already in the UK. I think there was quite a major incident in Heathrow last year where a pilot reported that he could see a drone was being flown alongside a plane as he was coming in to land. And, you know, there was an incident referring back to the kind of sporting events stipulation in the rules just last month with Wimbledon, where a drone was being flown over Wimbledon. And these are clear infringements. And I don't think anything truly awful has happened yet, but I think it's probably only a matter of time until that does happen, and there's not much that can be done to prevent that. And I know there have been people out there who've called for a registry of all drones. So when you buy a drone, you have to, you know, register it, and you have to kind of be accountable. But
at least one drone company has also explored the idea of having built-in GPS limits where drones function within. Although I think that proved to be unworkable.
Yeah, but the problem is that some of these drones, you know, you can buy them for pocket money, and they're not registering kids that are buying them.
Yeah, and you don't have to have any kind of training.
No.
Zero training, you can just go willy-nilly.
To some extent, we're also kind of waiting to see what happens with drone technology, and that kind of brings up something you mentioned earlier, which is a disturbing video out of America, somewhere in America, of a man who had attached a handgun to a drone.
Yeah, you might have seen this online. It's pretty shocking to see, but it was only a matter of time. Although he calls it a quadcopter, Katie. With guns attached, it was apparently part of a college project that the kid was doing. The guns were operated by trigger mechanism and in a safe place where there were no people, and it was published online and naturally went viral. But the bizarre thing about it, I mean, if you're not already finding that bizarre that you just strap guns to a drone, is that the police in the county in the US where this happened basically released a statement saying, average people would assume that this is totally illegal. However, we've been unable to find the law that says that. So there's nothing in their legal system that says that this is not allowed, which is mind-boggling. Like, it's absolutely mind-boggling. I don't understand why a firearm wouldn't have to be kind of in your possession, in your control. You're saying that it's on a drone that you're controlling, so it's in your control. But these are multiple guns attached to a drone spinning around, just letting out rounds.
I think it's almost better, you know, that these experiments are happening in an academic environment where they're testing the limits of drone technology and coming up with potential problems that people could perhaps legislate around before some amateur who has a handgun and a drone decides to create a weapon.
Well, this is a school kid.
Well, I mean,
I think definitely class them as an amateur. No, I see exactly what you mean, but this feels like the kind of thing that an actual organisation should be looking into, and they probably shouldn't just upload a cool video to YouTube of a gun just firing out shots. It should be a study saying, this is possible. People can do this. We need to make sure that there's legislation in place to make sure this never happens.
Again, though, is something that has, I imagine, come up in the past with RC helicopters and RC planes. I mean, you know, people attach all kinds of stuff to other stuff, and it's, you know, they attach them to outside of their cars or, you know, whatever. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of experimentation that goes on with bored people and weapons. But it is, you know, potentially disturbing. I think in reality, it's unlikely that we're going to see flocks of these things flying over crowded areas. But, you know,
well,
you never
know.
We
have very strict gun laws. And,
in the UK, but obviously in the US. US. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, the question of gun safety, I think, is a broader question in America and one that we're probably not going to be able to answer definitively here. But I think we would all, and I think a lot of gun owners in the States would say that paramount is using them safely and maintaining control and not pointing at anything you don't want to die, and all of those basic gun safety rules, which, not to get too political, but the NRA in America, which is now a very powerful gun lobby, was set up to be a safety organization. But the whole point of that was to train young people to use guns safely and not to treat them as toys.
But it's
that's now morphed into something darker. But it's you know, the point stands, I think, that people are going to have guns in America and they should learn to use them safely.
But I mean, this guy's done something, filmed it, thought it was fun. Loads of people obviously agree it's ridiculous to watch. But it's more like, I mean, people quite horrifying ideas. Like, it would be very easy if someone wanted to do this to do it.
It's true. I mean, but again, that plays into that question about who's publicising the video. And to be fair, we decided this week to publish that video. I think because of the safety implications and because it is so shocking and that it was something that clearly engaged people and engaged a lot of debate on our site. And hopefully we didn't publish that video in a way that was, hey, cool, look at this amazing thing. Yeah. You know, others did. But there is, again, a big tradition on the internet of tech blogs, particularly posting videos of people who have made homemade Wolverine claws or flamethrowers or nail guns, or they've attached blades to a lightsaber and they're playing. Like, it, I mean, that is a thing that comes up, and it's true. I think most people don't treat that as seriously as they should.
And I guess the gun lobby would just say crazy people would do crazy things. It doesn't matter.
I think it is important, though,
we can't stop people doing crazy things if they're...
Sometimes putting videos on the internet like this and proving that these things are possible does catch the attention of people who are completely not in this world. For example, a lot of legislators in the US who won't know anything about technology necessarily, but looking at how new technologies like drones, and also, you know, it wasn't that long ago that there was the 3D printed gun template put on the internet as well. You know, that's another technology that's being sort of weaponized in a way, I think there's a greater question here about understanding how these new technologies can be weaponized by amateurs.
US just goes straight to guns with new technology, doesn't it?
One could also make the point, though, that it is ironic that so much outrage was attached to an American producing a drone with a weapon that could potentially injure a civilian.
Well, exactly.
Considering global politics.
And actually, the US has been very much at the forefront of using drones in law enforcement. I mean, they've had to bring in rules, but various different law enforcement started using them for different purposes, for surveillance. And
could we attach a water cannon to one?
Because
you might
sure
want to tell Boris Johnson.
That. I'm sure they'll explore that, but they won't allow journalists to use them at a demonstration in the future. You don't want to catch that water cannon on camera.
Well, this feels like one of those stories that the next development almost certainly will be a negative one of maybe someone being injured. But I think it's a good move to attempt to codify these regulations and give people more information about using these serious things, which, like you said, Katie, are very cheap, but also potentially quite destructive. So that and all of our stories we've discussed this week are obviously on wired.co.uk. Please head there and check out more information about the things we've talked about. And also get in touch with us at podcast@wired.co.uk. We love your feedback. We love hearing from you guys. We know there's a lot of you out there, and it really makes a difference to us when you send an email, cheer us up, leave a comment on iTunes, or give us a good rating. I speak, you know, from the heart when I say I've only been here a short time, but this hour kind of just chatting and hearing from you, the readers, really makes a huge difference to all of our week. So let us know what you think about drones, about searching for aliens, about anything we've discussed,
about extramarital affairs. You can keep that to yourself, actually.
Yeah, why not send some hard searching criticism to the moralistic reactionary conservative that is Leah Clark.
Oh my god. Can't say anything. It's going to be stamped on my head forever. Have your affairs, it's fine. I just think you should be upfront about it.
But we're doing a lot more video currently on wired.co.uk, and we'd love your feedback for what kind of video you'd like to see. Do you want to see us in the office? Do you want to see a filmed version of the podcast? Do you want to see what we get up to when we go out and meet interesting people and see crazy ideas? What do you want to see? Because we're ready to show it to you. And we've got some big plans for video. Watch this space. But the more you can send us, the more we can find the time and resources to actually do cool stuff, which is ultimately what we're all here for. Well, that's everything we got this week. We'll see you again, or hear from you again, next time.
Bye.
Bye.